A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On The Radar News Analysis. You are now tuned into On The Radar News Analysis with me, Ndafa Happy Juju, being your host and keeping you informed from now up until 14:30. Now, it's Monday. Pardon me. No, it's Wednesday, the 15th of October, 2025. And as we continue with this new week, with the latest updates and stories shaping the national conversation. Of course, Wednesdays are known for getting the tone and just getting right into it, realigning and refocusing and being ahead of what's on the table. You're tuned into On The Radar News Analysis, the program where we take a closer look at Namibia's top stories, unpacking the headlines, the developments and the context behind them. Do join in on the conversation by sharing your views on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and WhatsApp. And listen to us also via the Eagle FM app or Eagle FM website. Remember, your voice helps shape the national dialogue. Now, whether you're listening in from the red sands of the Kalahari, the misty shores of Swakopmund, the quiet hills of Opuwo, the open plains of Omaheke, or right here in the heart of Windhoek, thank you for choosing Eagle FM as your source of trusted news and insight. Stay tuned. Now let's jump right into these top stories. The Bank of Namibia's Monetary Policy Committee, MPC, convened its fifth bi-monthly meeting for 2025 on the 13th and the 14th of October to deliberate on the country's monetary policy direction for the next 2 months. Now, following a detailed review of both domestic and global economic conditions, the MPC announced a reduction in the repo rate by 25 basis points, bringing it down from 6.75% to 6.50%. Now, according to the bank, this adjustment aims to continue supporting Namibia's economic growth while maintaining the stability of the Namibia dollar's peg to the South African rand. The committee noted that the decision reflects a balanced approach between stimulating the domestic economy and preserving overall financial stability. Speaking at the announcement is the Bank of Namibia's Governor, Johannes Kabagab. Let's take a listen.
The Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of Namibia decided to reduce the repo rate by 25 basis points to 6.5%. This was done to continue supporting the domestic economy while safeguarding the peg between the Namibia dollar and the South African rand. This was done following a review of international, regional and domestic economic developments. Our decision to reduce the repo rate is entirely data-driven. Let us consider the factors in the domestic economy that has informed this decision. Domestic economic activity has weakened. Inflation remains subdued, while growth in private sector credit extension has improved further, although it remains relatively weak. The merchandise trade deficit has narrowed further, while the stock of international reserves remains sufficient to maintain the currency peg and meet the country's international financial obligations. Real gross domestic product growth has surprised on the downside, fallen to a post-pandemic low of 1.6% year-on-year in the second quarter of 2025, from 3.3% during the corresponding period in 2024. This poor performance was primarily observed in the manufacturing, fishing and agriculture sectors. High frequency indicators further corroborate this trend, suggesting that the pace of expansion in economic activity during the first 8 months of 2025 has slowed compared to the same period in 2024. Looking ahead, real GDP growth for 2025 is projected to decline from 3.7% registered in 2024, with downside risk now more pronounced. Annual inflation remains contained, averaging 3.6% during the first 8 months of 2025, compared to 4.6% during the same period in 2024. This disinflation was primarily reflected in the categories of housing and alcoholic beverages, augmented by deflation in the transport category. Moreover, consumer price inflation has remained unchanged at 3.5% in September 2025 relative to its level in July 2025, although it temporarily dipped to 3.2% in August. Looking ahead, inflation projections for both 25 and 26 have been revised downward by 0.2 percentage point to 3.6% and 4% respectively compared to the previous forecast. This revision reflects a stronger exchange rate assumption and a downward revision to the oil price outlook. Rest to the forecast remain exchange rate volatility and potential upticks in administered and oil prices. The annual growth in private sector credit extension has continued on a gradual recovery path, rising to a post-pandemic high of 5.8% in August 2025 and remaining above the 5.7% recorded in June 2025. Similarly, the improvement in credit to the private sector was observed in the year-to-date average growth rate, which stood at 4.9% in the first 8 months of 2025 relative to 2% during the same period in 2024. Overall, the improvement in PSC was mainly driven by stronger credit uptake by businesses, while households lagged. Pivoting to the external sector, Namibia's merchandise trade deficit narrowed by 16.1% to 17.9 billion Namibian dollars during the first 8 months of 2025 relative to the corresponding period in the previous year. The improved trade deficit was on account of a fast increase in export earnings, especially from uranium and gold, relative to import payments during the period under review. The stock of international reserves stood at 54.7 billion Namibian dollars at the end of September 2025, a decline from 58.1 billion Namibian dollars recorded at the end of July. The reduction in foreign reserves was mainly ascribed to elevated imports, foreign payments by the government, and a stronger exchange rate. This level of foreign reserves translates to an estimated import cover of 3 to 6 months, remaining adequate to sustain the currency peg between the Namibia dollar and the South African rand and meet the country's international financial obligations. Let's consider international developments. The global economy continues to exhibit resilience. However, the medium-term outlook suggests marginally slower global growth. Since the previous MPC meeting, inflation patterns have diverged across monitored economies. Key global markets, stock markets gained, while bond yields fell. The U.S. Fed lowered its policy rate for the first time this year, while other monetary policy authorities mostly held the policy rates steady since the previous MPC meeting. Global growth has remained relatively resilient since the last MPC meeting. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, growth in the group of 20 economies, the G20, edged up slightly in the second quarter of 2025, largely sustained by the United States and India. Looking ahead, the IMF has projected global growth to moderate from 3.3% in 2024 to 3.2% in 2025 and 3.1% in 2026. The 2025 growth forecast is 0.2 percentage point higher than previously projected, reflecting gradual adaptation to trade tensions. Most monitored commodity prices have trended upwards since the previous MPC meeting. The price of gold has surged since the August MPC setting a record high, most recently buoyed by increased safe haven demand. Furthermore, zinc prices have continued their ascent, mainly due to tight global supply conditions. Despite a recent drop, copper prices remain notably elevated, ascribed to concerns regarding supply shortages amid disruptions at key copper mines. Turning to the energy sector, the uranium spot price has sustained gains, supported by supply constraints and rising demand. Conversely, crude oil prices have eased further, mainly due to increased supply and most recently concerns regarding the imposition of higher U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. Diamond prices were slightly lower than 2 months ago, partly reflecting continued competition from lab-grown diamonds. Key global stock markets generally recorded gains since the last MPC meeting, with a notable gain extended by the S&P 500, driven by technology stocks. Meanwhile, bond yields trended down across monitored economies, with significant declines in the United States and China. Bond yields also fell in South Africa, underpinned by stable fiscal signals and lower inflation expectations amid the central bank's expression of a preference for a low inflation target. Since the last MPC meeting, inflation trends have diverged across key economies. Among the advanced economies, inflation ticked up in the United States, the United Kingdom, and the euro area, while it continued to moderate in Japan. In contrast, inflation generally slowed in the monitored emerging market and developing economies, except in South Africa, where consumer prices edged up. Meanwhile, China recorded deflation during the same period. Looking ahead, the IMF's projections for global inflation have remained broadly unchanged, with inflation forecasts to decelerate from a revised 5.8% in 2024 to 4.2% in 2025 and 3.7% in 2026. Most of the monitored central banks held policy rates steady since the August 2025 MPC meeting. The exceptions were the U.S. Fed, which implemented its first rate cut for the year, and the Bank of Russia, also with a reduction. So given this, we need to consider the monetary policy stance. In determining the appropriate monetary policy stance, the committee considered the weaker domestic economic activity, well-contained inflation, and a favorable medium-term inflation outlook. Year-to-date capital flows were assessed to be orderly. The relatively high real repo rate and adequate foreign reserves were also deemed to be supportive of a reduction in the nominal repo rate. The MPC was worried that the lowering of a repo rate would widen the gap between the domestic policy rate and that of the anchor country, but was of the view that its magnitude falls within the boundaries where capital movements remain well contained. Moreover, while there is imminent pressure on foreign reserves due to forthcoming Eurobond redemption, thorough preparation in anticipation of this event has ensured that Namibia's foreign reserve adequacy is not jeopardized. Against this background, the MPC decided to reduce the repo rate by 25 basis points to 6.5%. Commercial banks are accordingly expected to cut their prime lending rates by the same margin to 10.125%. This policy stance will continue to support domestic economic activity while safeguarding the one-to-one link between the Namibia dollar and the South African rand.
Speaking to us also about the monetary policy's stance on the reduction of the repo rate is economist Peter Franz. Good afternoon, Peter Franz, and welcome to On the Reader News Analysis.
Good afternoon, Happy. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. The Bank of Namibia has announced its latest repo rate reduction, that is by 25 basis points. Just how is this reduction in the repo rate likely to affect borrowing costs for businesses and households in Namibia, Franz?
Yes, so as we know that the repo rate, or in other words, interest rate is the rate of borrowing, the cost of borrowing. So when the cost of borrowing goes down, so that means it has become very cheap. So accessible, people can access money on a lower rate, and also those people that have bought vehicles or any other assets and credit to the bank, so we expect those people to have a reduction in their installment period, in their installment amount. Yes, so it's basically the both businesses and the people who are like they are going to borrow at a very cheap price.
Yeah. Now, could this rate cut stimulate investment and consumer spending? And if so, how quickly might we see those effects?
Yes, so when the interest rate goes down, like when the repo rate goes down, that affects the investment negatively because people will not be motivated to invest because their returns will be affected in a negative manner. So in that case, what will happen is that now the interest have gone down, and then the returns will also follow suit because of the interest. There's a positive relationship between interest and investment. As interest goes up, investments also, the returns becomes very higher. We'll be motivated to invest. But in this case, it's the other way around.
Okay.
So, yeah, in the next, at least we should be able to see the impact in perhaps next month or the next 2 to 3 months.
Now, with the repo rate reduced, what is the risk of inflation rising, and how might the Bank of Namibia manage that risk?
Yes, so basically, when the interest rate goes down, this is also to stabilize the inflation rate, which also provides access to money. So a lot of people have access to money, they could borrow, and then the demand goes up. As the demand goes up, this follows the inflation rate because the suppliers are trying to match the demand pace as well as the way of the pace of their supply.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the bank cited the importance of maintaining the peg between the Namibian dollar and the South African rand. How does a lower repo rate influence the stability of this peg?
Yes, so basically it's because of the peg, we have to follow what South Africa is doing. We don't have to. Our interest rate should never be higher than South Africa's one, but it can be lower or the same.
Mm.
So in that case, most of the inflation, I think, it was already calculated because it's imported inflation. It's the inflation that comes to the product that we import from other countries. So, like, if the price in South Africa of bread increases to $20, me as an importer that bought the bread from South Africa, there's no way I can sell it for less than that.
Yeah.
So that's the inflation that was imported from South Africa that also affected us. So other measures is just to reduce the amount of money in circulation at some point, but now it's not possible because there will be a misalignment between our bond and the Ministry of World and then I think the government's objectives, which is to empower youth, and for you to empower youth, you have to give us the money, you have to lose now the expansionary fiscal policies on the cost.
Mm. Lastly, yes. Franz, in your view, does the rate cut signal optimism about the domestic economic outlook?
Sorry, say that again.
Does the rate cut signal optimism about the domestic economic outlook?
Yes, absolutely. If you see things that have been done so far, I think that are positively contributing to the economic growth and the economy at large, which also gives opportunities to reduce the risk that could be involved within the country. You see, how do I put it? You see, the youth fund that was given out, and also now the interest that is being reduced, you can see that these are aligning and also trying to just include everyone in the economy. So in this case, when it comes to, let's say, a risk of investment, should be reduced because the amount of funds entering the circulation, and also it could increase the income, like the business income overall.
Okay. Peter Franz, thank you so much for making time for us.
And with that, we pause right here now and take a trip to the marketplace.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Even a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Goeie nuus, Kimberg nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinter nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Kimberg te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Kimba bied in 'n onverbeterlike prys. Kimba, waar die wereld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Welcome back. Today marks the celebration of Global Ethics Day, a day dedicated to reflecting on the role of ethics in our daily lives, our institutions, and our society at large. It serves as a reminder of the importance of integrity, transparency, and accountability, values that form the foundation of the trust between people and the systems that serve them. Now, this year's theme, Ethics Re-envisioned, calls on individuals and organizations to rethink how ethical principles are practiced in a rapidly changing world, from boardrooms and classrooms to communities and public offices. Now, in light of this, the Government Institution Pension Fund, GIPF, has taken a proactive step by introducing a new whistleblower platform, strengthening its efforts to promote good governance and ethical conduct. Now, the initiative builds on GIPF's previous milestones, including the launch of its Ethics Help Desk and official website in 2022, and in order for it to provide a safe, confidential space for employees, members, and the public to report any unethical behavior, fraud, or corruption. Let's now take a listen to GIPF Chief Executive Officer Martin Inkumbi.
Global Ethics Day has become a valued tradition at GIPF. Since the launch of our ethics management program in July 2017, the fund has made significant strides in embedding ethical conduct into our fabric. Through continuous awareness, training, and leadership commitment, we have integrated ethics into our strategic objectives, policies, and operations. The journey has not been without challenges, but it has reinforced our belief that ethics is not a destination. It is a continuous pursuit of integrity, transparency, and accountability. Today's commemoration has three main objectives. One, to bring together our stakeholders in observing Global Ethics Day 2025. Two, to reaffirm our principles and practices. And three, to introduce our new whistleblower tool, which will enhance transparency, accountability, and a culture of speaking up without fear. As most of you are aware, we previously made use of the Ethics Desk or Ethics Help Desk, a South African-owned company, to provide our whistleblowing services. Following the conclusion of their contract, the services was put out on tender. After a thorough evaluation process, the contract has been awarded to Deloitte Namibia. Deloitte is a local entity that offers whistleblowing services in several Namibian languages, an important enhancement compared to the previous services provided by the Ethics Help Desk. The new whistleblower tool will be managed under the leadership of Deloitte country leader, Ms. Ellen Harrison, who is here today and will be sharing more information on it later in the program. Ladies and gentlemen, the essence of ethics re-envisioned lies in our ability to see ethics as a strategic enabler, one that drives better workplace outcomes, stronger governance, and a more resilient institution. When employees uphold integrity in their daily action, it leads to trust, and trust is the foundation of performance. As Warren Buffett once remarked, and I quote, "It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it," unquote. That is why every decision we make must reflect ethical considerations, because the cost of losing trust is immeasurable. As technology evolves around the globe, GIPF has also been leveraging technology to improve efficiencies in the way we do things. However, with this advancement comes new risks, cyber threats, data breaches, and internal control vulnerabilities. While digitization plays a huge role, ethics remains our first and strongest line of defense. A few years ago, the fund uncovered a case of internal fraud perpetrated by 2 employees who exploited control gaps for personal gain. This incident, which attracted public attention, was a painful reminder that ethical lapses can undo years of progress and damage institutional credibility. But we choose to respond with transparency, accountability, and reform by tightening controls, improving oversight, and reinforcing a culture of honesty. From this, we learn that true integrity is not about erring, but about confronting wrongdoing decisively and learning from it. As former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson once said, and again I quote, "If you have integrity, nothing else matters. If you don't have integrity, equally nothing else matters," unquote. Meaning integrity is non-negotiable. Without it, even the best strategies, systems, and structures are meaningless. I urge all staff, when you see control weaknesses, report them. Do not exploit them. Let us all be guardians of the fund's integrity. As we introduce the new whistleblower platform today, we encourage all employees and stakeholders to use it responsibly. It exists to expose genuine concerns about ethical conduct, not to settle for personal grievances, spread misinformation, or disclose confidential information. Of course, we do acknowledge that for you to blow a whistle, you need to provide information. We further encourage our employees to make use of the whistleblower platform as the appropriate channel for reporting ethical concerns, as opposed to disclosing confidential information with the media. Media outlets often publish information as received without the benefit of thorough verification and investigation. Such disclosures may inadvertently tarnish the image of the fund, while doing little to ensure that the potential culprits of wrongdoing are brought to book. Let us embrace this tool in the spirit of constructive accountability to correct, not to destroy, to build, not to break. Speaking up should always be guided by our shared value of integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, speaking about our values, integrity, teamwork, service excellence, and care. These are not mere words on paper. They are our ethical compass. Integrity means doing the right thing, even when nobody is watching. Teamwork means resolving challenges collaboratively. Service excellence means putting our members first. Care means acting with empathy and humanity in all what we do. If we live these values daily, we will not only comply with ethical standards, but we will be leading by example.
Speaking also at the GIPF's introduction of the new whistleblower platform is Penda Ithindi, chairperson of the board.
Well, I warmly welcome you to this Global Ethics Day 2025 commemoration, hosted by yours truly, the Government Institutions Fund, your fund, our fund. Celebrated every third Wednesday of October in any year we have come to learn, the World Ethics Day has become an overly prescribed platform for organizations and the community settings to explore and rekindle values and principles shaping ethical thought leadership, shaping decision-making, and shaping corporate practice everywhere. The 2025 Global Ethics Day is celebrated under the theme Ethics Re-envisioned. This theme, ladies and gentlemen, is not only timely, it is relevant. Why relevant? Because we have seen that at the current juncture, and we do not need to go far at home, but as you go far in the region and in the globe, one knows that there are seismic changes taking place globally, testing multilateralism, way of decision making globally, and unpredictable geopolitical shiftings and rotations that sometimes manifest in conflicts and armed conflicts and so on. Go no further in the Middle East, for instance, and look at the extent of savagery that is taking place. Is that ethical? Look at the corporate governance and the number of corporations and the businesses. Do we have ethical practice that we can say that this is a trend to emulate, or there are lessons to be learned? So this theme, ladies and gentlemen, the Right Honourable Prime Minister summons us to revisit, to reimagine, and to recommit ourselves to the ethos and the principles of ethical leadership, to the practices as key ingredients of corporate governance and societal transformation. In the face of this celebration, the GIPF, your GIPF, our GIPF, opted to host this national platform as an activation platform so that we achieve certain objectives. We start actually achieving and cultivating a spirit of achieving certain objectives. Three of them are important. First, we have chosen to act this activation platform so that we bring together the assemblage of expertise represented in this room and those that are following us and streaming in live in various platforms, social platforms, in order for us to reminisce on the pathways to greatly embed solid ethical practices in our organization, organizational cultures, solid ethical practices at individual level, and in our societal settings. Right Honourable Prime Minister, you whispered to me that next door there are, hackers, computer hackers, AI innovators. And in the world of innovation and increasingly innovation, leveraging technology, of course you have seen that there is also fallout on the ethical issues, and sometimes you say that this person pitching in on this platform and quite particular on these utterances, is this ethical enough, or is it a bit overstretching the use of technology that has come by? And these issues need to be concretized. We need to reminisce on this and say that what are those peer learnings and the best practices that we could take forward. Secondly, this platform enables us to benefit from the insights and thought leadership of eminent individuals that will be addressing and talking to us today. You have the likes of Advocate Bill Gavinus. You have the likes of Chitunga Elijah Murari, ours truly, who do not only speak from abstraction of theories, but from practice. And it's not practice of others, but practice lived and the track record set. You do not need to go far, but look at the track record. You say, that what is it that could be emulated? Last, to recommit ourselves to gain traction on the ethical front for more organizational value creation, local, at home. And for a more equitable and just society, which we have always sought for, to be the Namibia today and the Namibia tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, the GIPF, through its Board of Trustees, is committed to upholding the high-level standards of integrity, standards of ethical leadership, and we expect these as the custodians of the fund to filter through to every level of the fund as we continue to make good on the promise that we have made to our members as the beneficiaries of the fund and to the stakeholders, individuals, and organizations, because we do not exist in isolation. We have consistently made an undertaking through our mission statement, and our mission statement speaks for itself. And it speaks itself through the value that the fund has created over time in terms of its asset base and in terms of developmental impact in the local economy and the returns to the members. And this is the mission: to guard the fund and to grow the fund to the benefit of our members and to the benefit of the country. We cannot, therefore, from a board perspective, for example, emphasize enough the need to provide ethical leadership to the fund. We cannot be expected to set the standards higher for others, but we do not emulate this as the guardians of the fund. As American physicist Robert Noyce once said, if ethics are poor at the top, their behavior is copied down through the organization, end of quote. In reflecting on the fund's profile, ethical profile, the GIPF has over the past 8 years or so have actually taken concerted, accelerated steps to ensure that we increasingly embed ethical considerations and integrity considerations in the DNA of the fund, so that this becomes actually culture, way of life for us. This has seen us normalizing important aspects, but look simple, but quite important to normalize in one's DNA.
And with that, we now pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll work with you more right here on the Radar News Analysis. Stay tuned.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Welcome back. And now I'm joined in studio by Dwight Ling. A very good afternoon to you, Dwight, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
How are you doing, Happy? And good afternoon to the listeners for today's On the Radar.
Mm-hmm. Dwight, as of 30th September, or let's say at the end of September 2025, the capital development project by the government, the implementation of the budget for the capital or development project by the government, is so far only, as announced by the minister, Erica Shafuda, has been only at less than 30%, and which is 9.7 billion Namibian dollars of the capital budget. Now, Dwight, why is this so? Considering that we are coming to the end of the financial year of 2024-2025, heading obviously in 2025-2026.
Well, happy. Okay, so the government financial year, just for the listeners to understand, actually ends every 30 March. I just want to be sure about that month date, but it's every 30 month, meaning it 30 March at the end of every March. It runs from 1 April to 30 March every year. Usually, under the previous administration, which was the administration of President Geingob, which later on in the last year of last year, 2024, was then supervised or seen over by President Bumba, was that you had the Minister of Finance announce the new budget in the month before, that would be February, before 30 March or before the month of March. So that as to give the economy the indication in terms of, you know, what would be the focus areas for the government to focus on in terms of infrastructure, in terms of projects, in terms of welfare and so forth and so forth. Now, when you've got to look at the discussion, obviously, of this particular discussion, it is born from an engagement that Minister Shifuda did back in the month of September, regarding obviously now getting the data and information from the various public sector stakeholders. So I'm talking about local authorities, regional authorities, and the extension offices of ministries across the country in terms of what did they do, could they implement their projects, and so forth and so forth. Now, that is where the less than 30% indication comes from that the minister made in a recent engagement last week with civil society, which took place on Thursday last week. So the minister cited that particular rollout. Now, she did not explain what were some of the issues. One of the particular issues that she just aggregated in one response, primarily from the various particular respondents, you know, in terms of research, you always call them respondents, people that give you data or information, is that the procurement process is the bog down. It is literally the hampering process or the mechanism, the one thing that hampers local procurement across the country. Now, if Namibians obviously have cited and looked at this particular question, that discussion, this particular focal point, it is not the first time that procurement has been cited as being the major hurdle in terms of low development budget implementation. Because here's the thing, Happy. The unfortunate thing is, if you've got an example like the example that Helmut and myself on the home run that we jokingly use this example because it was referenced literally in a standing committee engagement with the Ministry of Justice and the Judiciary Executive Directors and other ministerial staff from other ministries that play support functions to these two ministries, was that the Oversight Committee, the Parliamentary Oversight Committee for Legal Affairs and the Constitution, discovered that the Oshakati High Court door had stood unfixed or unrepaired for like 6 months back last year. The time frame that I counted would have been 6 months, primarily up to the time that we had the conversation on the radio. Now, what came out about from that particular engagement was that the Oversight Committee then asked all officials there, why is it taking so long to replace a door? Because it's one of those doors, Happy, that are specially made for the building. So it's not a door that you buy in a shop anyway. It's a door that's specially made, and what it done is it had fallen off its hinges. That was the discussion that was cited there. And if you look at that particular case study, that focal point, that narrowing in on an actual issue where procurement had been shown as to being a tedious, long time consuming process, then the response that came out from there was that one of the officials there said, unfortunately, Member of Parliament, It's the procurement act and the procurement process that is taking too long.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to understand, Happy, the discussion in terms of if you see something that needs to be fixed, and this is an operational issue. Remember, this is not a development issue. It's an operational issue I'm showing out to you. The issue there was that even though you know someone that can fix a door, that, you know, can put the door back on its hinges, and you want to bypass procurement, the procurement procedure, the issue is primarily that you can obviously see that the public officials are afraid of probably being investigated by the ACC or being arrested by one or other particular financial crimes unit from the police and so on, or from the FIC or so on. Because it ultimately means that there is a fear scenario in terms of ensure that all dots, all I's are dotted and all T's are crossed before you just pick up your phone and call someone to say, hey, listen, I've got a door that needs to be fixed. We'll issue the particular, what's the thing's name? Mm-hmm. The purchase order. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to come and fix this door immediately? So it is literally bogging down such certain issues, because that's literally what the minister cited herself when she engaged with civil society, that the feedback she got was that the procurement process is or seems to be a time-consuming, tedious process, and that primarily it's this last safeguard that has to be kept intact so as to avoid any negative public views. But here's the thing, Happy. I mean, certain particular ministries obviously have not made this look good, this particular discussion of mm-hmm. looking good in the public perspective
yeah.
in recent years.
Mm. But I understand that procurement process obviously is a need, and it also helps in terms of keeping in check, balances in check, so that people don't do just what they want. But when it delays national policies, such as, for instance, here now as we're having this conversation, Dwight, then what perhaps measures should then be looked at to see maybe let's try to speed up this process. What maybe talks needs to be done in order for this to then not have the same issue of, because it's not just in the ministry itself or implementation of this budget that needs to be put in place, but it's many avenues and many areas where procurement process really delays the actual work being done.
Happy, currently on the table in the National Assembly platform is that there is an amendment bill that is being put forward to amend parts of the current procurement act. And apparently, it has been also been cited that the new bill that showed up last week or the week before is different from a bill that the former finance minister, Ipumbu Shimi, had also tabled in the parliament or, submitted to the parliament or National Assembly for discussion and debate. So this ultimately seems that, in terms of improving the single aspect or the single mechanism that is supposed to be the safeguard, there are various particular suggestions being put forward to try and improve this. Now, if I go down that particular rabbit hole itself, Happy, we would end up with a discussion in terms of primarily it would change or sort of like shift people's thinking in a different direction in terms mm-hmm. of potentially what the officials in government are trying to fix
yeah.
versus what actually needs to be fixed. The discussion on the particular ground has been, if you go to many countries, many towns across the country,
mm-hmm.
You don't see much change, Abby, in terms of whatever particular development programs have been rolled out. The various oversight reports that I've had access to from not just standing committees, but also from the Auditor General's office have cited also the aspects in terms of procurement being a problem. And primarily, if you have to look at capital or capital project development, how many of that is centralized in Windhoek, meaning either the National Planning Commission takes charge of all information and understanding the project management discussion regarding capital projects, meaning large-scale projects, or if you look at a scenario in terms of regional development programs, then you cite and see that it's either a system of that the project is managed from Windhoek, or secondly, the project does not kick off or does not take lift off from on the regional level or in the local authority level, primarily because it seems that no one knows how to start this particular project
yeah.
from the ground.
Mm.
So you've got these two systems, these two settings currently that have been researched, meaning oversight committees have gone out to various parts of the country. Ministries and Auditor Generals and the Auditor General's office have been taking stock of these particular engagements, and it gives you insight in terms of potentially why things, not just the Procurement Act, but things literally that people can implement and do on the ground. Why is it taking so long? And
yeah.
in many cases, the straightforward answer you would get is that everything is controlled from Windhoek, primarily giving you the indication of the highly centralized planning and implementation that takes place from Windhoek.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the notion in terms of a conversation like the decentralization of said particular planning coming through or should be transmitted through the country should be the overall aim. And the unfortunate thing is, Happy, is that we sit with an act known as the Decentralization Act of 2000. It is a dormant act. Mm-hmm. I only discovered this act at the start of this year.
Mm.
We've had a conversation on Eagle FM on the home run about this act, because the conversation about this act popped up regarding debates that the National Assembly were having about a regional and local authority development fund. Now, you can obviously hear now from, okay, but we've got the NDP6, we've got national development budgets that are given. Why are we talking about a development fund for local authorities and regional authorities? Well, primarily, Happy, how it is supposed to be is that the regional authorities and the local authorities across the country are supposed to develop themselves. It shouldn't come from planning from the Ministry of Urban and Rural Development, the Ministry of Finance here, and the Ministry of Agriculture, Water, Land Reform and Fisheries. They are only supposed to receive, you know, what projects are being completed in terms of the improvement of livelihoods across the country. It's the local authorities and the regional authorities. They're supposed to do these jobs. The unfortunate thing is, seeing now in 2025 that we've had this act for 25 years and nothing has come about from it, and this act speaks about a development fund that was supposed to have been implemented for the local authorities and regional authorities, also once again shows that we have laws and acts being generated in legislation. The average Namibian doesn't know about these things. The average councillor in these other parts of the country don't know these things.
Yes.
And then in 2025, you have to hear about, oh, you guys are supposed to plan your own development, do your own planning, do your own service provision, do your own needs assessments of your communities. And those are the concerns. And unfortunately, this is the only time that I actually tried to defend ministers.
Yeah.
It's not the responsibility of a minister to sort out a local council's issues in a town. It's not their responsibility. So the unfortunate thing is, whether local councils like it or not, they're supposed to do the work. And like the minister, James Nkwasa, has said before, if you are not doing anything, why are you a councillor? Wherever you find yourself. And that's just me citing his words or quoting his words, because he has made that statement before. And it actually rings true, because the same thing also that comes through from the president herself in terms of saying, hey, listen, everybody's got to pull their weight. It's not Windhoek's job to plan for everyone. And you have to look at this, Happy, in terms of a discussion of where does Namibia's actual human, meaning highly skilled Namibians, highly paid Namibians, business entrepreneurs, business people, major bank corporations, major financiers from those banking corporations, where do they all sit? They all sit in Windhoek. They don't sit in Otjiwarongo. They don't sit in Gobabis. They don't sit in Oshakati. They don't sit in Rundu. They don't sit in Kitmans. They sit all in Windhoek. So obviously it means that these local authorities and regional authorities have to step up to the plate, Happy, and they have to actually do their part in national development. So what we mean by that is they've got to go and, you know, put forward plans to say, hey, listen, this is our mass housing designation plan to bring in new housing developments. Let's, for example, say in Karasburg, or let's say, for example, in Tsumkwe, or let's say, for example, in Ana, or let's say, for example, in Katima. They've got to do these jobs. It's not Windhoek's job. Windhoek should just approve the budgeting, but it's not Windhoek's job to say, we must think, we must work, we must plan for you, everything for you.
Exactly. And some of these things, some of these projects that are on the table are not even as tough to the core to see that they need to be implemented or to be first discussed at the top level. Then honestly, it's something that can be really down at grassroots level and still be executed well and enough.
Exactly. Just to sort of like share the last particular point, Happy, the unfortunate thing is what many Namibians have to also look at if they are unhappy about, you know, projects being completed because The civil society audience that the minister met with on Thursday last week was based on a particular conversation point of the minister wanted to cite, hey, listen, U.S. civil society, most of you have to endeavor and deal with human development issues. So we're talking about things like education, health, safety, security components, care for elderly and vulnerable children. And that's what most of the civil society come from. And then obviously you've got the nature conservation guys and the environmental management guys that are also part of that civil society endeavor. So you could see that in one scenario, they were slightly, these were Namibians that represented, you know, interest groups that come from, certain spheres of the Namibian landscape. The actual Namibians that should have heard this were Namibians that own businesses, that are farmers, that are potentially also, you know, people that sit with the capital and the means of capital production in the country. They were the ones that also should have then had their own station in terms of where they would ask, you know, what do you do regarding actors, bad actors? Mm-hmm. Or what do you do in terms of if you're a person living in an urban area, what do you do regarding youth unemployment discussions? Because there are only 5 businesses, let's for example say in a town like Omaruru. Or what do you do about, you know, the care in a town, let's for example say, who can I pick as a small, let's say in a town like Tess, for example.
Okay.
It's not a town, actually. It's actually a village council. So when you have to look at those particular things, there's also a needs assessment between rural communities and urban communities.
Mm-hmm.
Urban communities obviously are closer to services. Rural communities are obviously, in many cases, they are detached or they are separated from any services. Now, who supplies them with the service? Because an urban community knows that they subscribe to a local authority, which is a town council. And a rural community, they, in some cases, they have to try and call a local authority, a town council's people, to ask them, give us services. And if you've got that particular scenario, the unfortunate thing is a local authority will say, hey, listen, you're not part of us. You are part of a rural constituency.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to call the governor and the governor's office and the regional authority, not us, the town council or the village council. So you also sit with those two dilemmas, actually with that dilemma in the national planning of Namibia in terms of how do you look after, who do you look after first? Do you look after the urban communities where they are paying taxes and paying for services in an urban setting, or do you look after the rural communities where in many cases they have way less access to services like the urban communities have.
Mm.
And unfortunately, there's also a scenario in terms of if you try to measure their particular ability to pay for taxes and to pay for services, you find there's also levels of resistance coming through in that scenario. Mm.
Dwight Links, thank you so much for breaking that down for us. We really appreciate that.
Not a problem, Abby.
Okay. And there you had it from my colleague, journalist and reporter Dwight Links. Now for now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. When we return, we'll be telling you what's making headlines in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. Stay tuned right here on the Radar News Analysis.
Goeie nuus, Skimbad nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinte nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Skimbad te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Welcome back. Now, comparing the Namibian dollar to other currencies, one Namibian dollar, one US dollar today will get you 17 Namibian dollars and 31 cents, and one euro is equals to 20 Namibian dollars and 13 cents. One Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 28 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 23 Namibian dollars and 11 cents. 1 Swiss franc is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 62 cents, while 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. Now move over to trading economics. Now India's unemployment rate rose slightly to 5.2% in September 2025 from 5.1% in August, in line with market expectations following 2 consecutive months of declines. Now the uptick was driven by higher unemployment in rural areas at 4.6% versus 4.3%, and a modest rise in urban areas at 6.8% versus 6.7%. Among females, the rate increased to 9.3% in urban areas from 8.9% and 5.5% in rural areas, while male unemployment saw moderate gains in both rural at 4.7% versus 4.5% and urban regions at 6.0% versus 5.9%. Now, despite the rise in unemployment, the employment rate increased to 52.4% and the labor force participation rate climbed to 55.3%, marking their highest levels since April. Meanwhile, U.S. stock futures rose on Wednesday with contracts on the S&P 500 up 0.6%. Now the NASDAQ 100 gaining of 0.8% and Dow Jones advancing 200 points. Ireland's trade surplus narrowed to 5.25 billion euros in August 2025 from 6.25 billion euros a year earlier, as exports fell more sharply than imports. Total exports declined 6.7% to 16.2 billion euros, driven by a 20.4% drop in medical and pharmaceutical products to 6.5 billion euros, partly offset by a 35.7% surge in organic chemicals to 2 billion euros. And that was what we had for you in terms of economic indicators. We pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. Now, should you also be interested in the news analysis, 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Otherwise, I'll see you after the commercial break.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my cattle. Menace,
right?
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now we take you to news beyond the borders of Namibia. We start off regionally, move over to continental news and then international news. Now we're starting off in South Africa, where the International Monetary Fund has increased South Africa's growth forecast by 1.1%. Let's take a listen.
The word uncertainty seems to be the IMF's favourite word this year. US-China trade war, global tariffs, they're all creating a lack of predictability. And in its 168-page World Economic Outlook report, the word uncertainty appears 102 times. IMF officials on Tuesday outlined how tariff shocks have already impacted economies, but not by as much as they predicted earlier this year. That said, they also warned those tariff effects could get worse, leading to weaker growth, weaker labour markets, and increased inflation. The US, the IMF noted, is already feeling those effects from policies put in place by the US president himself. South Africa is predicted to see 1.1% growth this year. That's a modest increase compared to July's forecast, a bump up of 0.1%. It's also more than double 2024's overall growth, which was 0.5%. And further good news, the IMF forecasts that South Africa will see continued growth in 2026. As for sub-Saharan Africa, the IMF sees overall growth for the region at 4.1% this year, the same as last year. And looking further afield, and this is where those ever-changing tariff policies make it harder to predict the future, the IMF says any continuation of trade wars will lead to prolonged uncertainty, more protectionism, and labour market shocks. As for global stock markets, the IMF's annual Global Financial Stability Report looked at how recent resiliency might give way to asset prices falling suddenly and sharply. Changing investor expectations about AI could trigger re-evaluations about worth, while growing government debt and the growth of stablecoins could, the IMF said, spread stress. Nick Harper, SABC News, Washington.
Meanwhile, KZN and ANC are set to engage in talks with IFP in order to mend ties.
Tensions between the ANC and IFP are threatening the stability of the KwaZulu-Natal government of provincial unity. This follows the ousting of ANC's Umkhanya Kude District Municipality Mayor, Siphile Mdaka, and Speaker Solomon Mkhombo through a vote of no confidence. They were replaced by IFP councillors. The ANC's youth wing recently accused the IFP and DA of secretly undermining the ANC through political interference. The party says what happened in Umkhanya Kude is rather unfortunate.
We regard that as the ANC as a defining moment in our relationship. Having said that, though, the ANC and the IFP are currently in the process of setting up a meeting so that we can be able to sit together and to discuss. Now, of course, there are many views that have been expressed publicly with regard to this matter. The one thing, though, that the ANC was simply saying, our position still remains until such time that the ANC and the IFP has had its own discussions over the matters that we must deal with.
KwaZulu-Natal Premier Thami Ntuli has released preliminary findings of an investigation into alleged fraud and corruption in ANC-led departments. The probe was launched over tender irregularities and political interference claims involving Health MEC Nomakoko Simelane and Education MEC Sipho Hlomuka. Ntuli has referred the matter to the Special Investigation Unit for further investigation.
But in doing so, we must do this within a well-established procedures and within the rule of law. And in an instance where each and every person who works for the public must account, the ANC will have no problem about that as a matter of principle. Where the ANC has a problem, it's like what we have said before, it's when we actually are seeing that there is a targeted approach in respect of ANC-run departments. And that one for us is a no-no. And we have said we will not allow anyone to weaponize any power that has been given to them through our own participation in the government of provincial unity.
The ANC has also responded to the MK Party's notice of a motion of no confidence against the Premier. Mabuya Khulu says the ANC has not been approached by the MK Party or anyone else regarding this matter. I'm Nhlakanipho Magwaza for SABC News in Durban.
Meanwhile, Zambia hosts a League of African Ambassadors. Let's take a listen.
Africa's voice should not be ignored from the global platform. Current and former diplomats have gathered in the Zambian capital, Lusaka, to unveil the League of the African Ambassadors. Zambian Foreign Affairs Minister Mulambo Haimba says this is a critical time.
Expectations are high, and also that I think the other aspect of it is that they are a resource. They continue to be a resource, both present, currently serving, and those that served in the past. Probably those that served in the past more than the present ones. And we can, each of us as governments, lean on this resource and draw from it. As you said already, and as I mentioned earlier, the environment is ever-changing in the world, on the globe. But also, we as a continent, as Africa, as you could hear from the remarks from the chairperson of the African Union Commission, it also feeds into our Vision 2063.
Africa. African ambassadors say they're keen to work with their governments in ensuring that diplomacy is sustained in a volatile global environment.
The various ambassadors, our high commissioners, they have gained a lot of experience working in countries of jurisdiction outside Zambia. For instance, I was in Germany for like 4 years. Before that, I was in Sweden for another 3 years. So the networks and the knowledge that we gain while we are away, the League of African Ambassadors have decided that instead of putting it on the shelves and let it gather dust, we should come up with a think tank. That think tank should be able to advise us when there is a conflict somewhere in the DRC or when there is a business opportunity in Cape Town, who best would be there to be a buffer zone between the government or existing ambassadors. And it was felt that the best people who could do that are people that already have, that possess the experience and the networks.
Indeed, you're right. In fact, it's symbolic that the league is being launched in Lusaka, but even more symbolic that it is being launched at Mulungushi Conference Center. It is here where the peace agreements of Mozambique, of Angola, of the DRC have taken place. It is here where SADC was established. It is here where COMESA was established. So it is symbolic for us to launch this organization in what we would loosely call the City of Peace.
Meanwhile, the League of the African Ambassadors says it seeks to be at the forefront of promoting African heritage, African unity, and it remains a non-political association. Kyle Kumalo, SABC News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Zambia is set to export its first beef to DRC.
President Hakainde Hichilema has officially addressed the Southern Province Investment and Trade Exposition in Livingstone. During an engagement with traditional leaders, the president announced positive developments regarding beef exports.
Your government is driving economic development for jobs, for a youthful population, for business opportunities for all, but also for treasury income. This week, we are delivering the first consignment of beef exports into Congo DR. And that beef is coming from Namwala, Mwamugobela, Mwamungaila. First, I refused to be one of those exporting first lot. I said, let me give it to my colleagues first. So, but the good news is that chief, I don't know which chief is in charge of Kalomo Town. Is that Spatunyana? Mwami Spatunyana, the beef ngombe from Namwala are being slaughtered in your chiefdom because that's the abattoir that qualifies. You can see how you work together now. And so the slaughter is going on. Last night I was checking, they were working the whole night. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, today is Tuesday, yes. Wednesday the movement goes, first shipment of beef into Congo. Amuligambire.
The president also took the opportunity to urge traditional leaders to help prevent bushfires, which have continued to affect agriculture. He further called on chiefs to make land available for developmental projects in their chiefdoms.
You sit on a substation or nearby, or you share a boundary with another chiefdom, come together quickly so that we can stick a power station there. I'm only giving a small example around energy and power station. If you sit on water, let's work together because we want irrigation, either for hydro or for irrigation. You have good farming land, fertile land, Mwami Giganta. We want to encourage more production of food in there. You sit on flat plains, please ensure abantu benu tabaumpi mililo. We zumbova umpa mali. My cages of beef. Na mabanda mwaumpa wizu mwabumpa. We can. Let's not stop investments.
Looking ahead to the 2026 general elections, President Hichilema warned against political violence, stressing the importance of maintaining peace throughout the electoral process.
Elections are coming. No one will be allowed to cause chaos. Election is coming, it's not for fighting, it's for choosing leaders. So we will be very firm on that. Polite but firm. Democracy does not equate lawlessness, doesn't equate disorder.
He also encouraged citizens.
Democracy does not equate lawlessness and does not equate disorder. That's the word. Those are the words of President Hakainde Hichilema. Now, Tanzania's mining sector thrives following reforms.
Tanzania is beginning to reap the benefits of sweeping reforms in its mining industry. The Mining Commission says the sector's contribution to the GDP has climbed from more than 7% in 2021 to more than 10% in 2024, and is projected to grow even higher by the end of this year.
The strategy of the government led by Dr. Samia Suluhu Hassan is to increase jobs for Tanzanians. One way of achieving this is by encouraging investments, especially those that create employment for both skilled and unskilled workers.
Government data shows revenue from the mining sector rose $254 million in 2021 to $307 million in 2024, a jump of more than 20%. More than 300,000 people are now employed in the industry. Analysts say the reforms could unlock even more opportunities.
Right now we are actually thinking about the critical minerals and energy transition. And Tanzania obviously stands out to be vested with a huge deposit of the critical minerals that are now in demand, specifically graphite and nickel, which aligns with the global EV demand, that is obviously the electrical vehicles.
Since 2017, Tanzania has overhauled its mining laws to boost government revenue and local participation, introducing new ownership structures and tighter export controls. According to the Ministry of Minerals and World Bank, these reforms have strengthened oversight, improved transparency, and attracted new investments into the sector.
One of the major changes brought about by the amendments to Tanzania's Mining Act in 2019 is that the government now owns a 16% stake in all major mining operations in the country. Analysts suggest that this ensures that ordinary citizens benefit from a sector that was previously difficult to access.
The government says reforms will continue with a renewed focus on the country's more than 1 million artisanal miners who have been vital to the sector's recent growth.
We need to ensure the safety of our miners so they are not exposed to the danger of collapsing shafts. Without the right equipment, it's impossible to increase production, ensure workers' safety, protect the environment, or add value to our minerals. Technology is the bridge to transforming this sector.
Experts note that only 16% of Tanzania's territory has been surveyed for minerals, a sign of both the country's vast untapped potential and the work that still lies ahead. Isaac Lukando, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
Africa's pension assets lag behind global average, limiting growth and jobs.
At 35, clinical psychologist Simon Sembiro says saving for the future isn't easy, with daily expenses rising. Putting money aside often takes a backseat.
Life is quite hard and expensive, and there are lots of taxation on everything. For a salary earner like me, you find that there is pay as you earn. There is also NSSF, which is also deducted on your account, and you find that you have a lot of bills.
That struggle is widespread. Uganda's National Social Security Fund says only a small share of workers contribute to formal pension schemes, with most earning in the informal sector.
Expand pension coverage and deepen the pension capital pool. It's a lie that the informal sector doesn't save. They do. They only save in cows and land and goats. Can we help them save that in money, so that we can monetize the saving?
Across the continent, Africa's pension assets are estimated at between $700 billion and $1 trillion US dollars, still less than 1% of the world's pension wealth. Analysts say the low savings mean less money for investment in infrastructure, housing, and job creation, the very things young populations need most.
Financial experts say Africa's growing workforce could be an opportunity if more of their earnings are turned into long-term savings to fund local development.
The United Nations says stronger pension systems could help countries build resilience and reduce poverty in old age.
Africa must look inward, mobilizing domestic savings, diaspora remittances, and blended finance models to reduce aid dependency. Given that 15 of the 20 traditional donor partners have reduced their funding, forcing a rethink of how development is financed, Africa needs to shift from aid to trade.
Private investors say young Africans are already driving innovation. With the right incentives, their savings could do the same. For Simon Sembiro, saving remains a daily struggle, but also a goal worth pursuing.
Startups, small-scale businesses. For example, we have people who sell chapatis in a day, and you discover they may not seem like they earn a lot of money, but those guys make a lot of money because they do a lot of saving on the chapatis and the small things that they sell. But the first saving helps in the way that at least you are able to attain a goal in a nearby future.
From Kampala to Lagos, Africa's challenge is clear. Turning today's young earners into tomorrow's investors. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN Kampala, Uganda.
Meanwhile, Gaza peace deal phase one of ceasefire agreement has been signed in Egypt.
Leaders from 27 countries have witnessed the signing of a ceasefire deal in Egypt. U.S., Egypt, Qatar, Turkey signed as mediators and guarantors, committing to the full implementation of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said the agreement opens a new era of stability in the Middle East. El-Sisi, together with U.S. President Donald Trump, said the search for the bodies of Israeli hostages under the rubble in Gaza would be a priority this week. Meanwhile, the scaling up of humanitarian aid is underway. The UN says Israel approved for 190,000 tons of food, shelter items, medicine, and other supplies to enter the strip, and that's 20,000 more than previously agreed. Aid workers say that they are now able to move more easily within Gaza after previously experiencing constant access restrictions imposed by Israeli authorities. A global hunger monitor in August determined that Gaza City and surrounding areas are officially suffering from famine. Well, let's get more on this. For more in-depth discussion, we have Ambassador Mutaz Ahmedan Khalil live in Cairo. Ambassador Khalil is a former permanent representative of Egypt to the United Nations in New York. Ambassador, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us here on Africa Live. Ambassador, first and foremost, what are your reflections on the deal? Do you believe the hard work is done, as U.S. President Donald Trump suggests?
Well, thank you very much for having me in CGTN for the first time. And this is an excellent question, actually, because everybody is talking about the deal, but nobody does exactly know what is the deal that has been signed. In a couple of hours ago, a statement has been released by the White House containing a certain declaration that speaks about it, a commitment to the Trump peace agreement and to good relations between Israel and its neighbors in general terms. Well, that is not a deal. That is a general declaration. We have two other documents, the 20-point Trump peace plan, not a deal, not an agreement, and the agreement on the ending of the Gaza war, the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement. This last one is fine, and it has been implemented. The hostage release and the exchange of prisoners and the ceasefire has almost been implemented. But if we talk about the Trump peace plan, it is very ambiguous. It has not been signed by any party. Everybody is, of course, welcoming the fact of stopping the war and letting humanitarian aid get through. But there are many ambiguous points, especially with regard to the obligations of Israel and its main sponsor, the United States. That is why I think there are tough negotiations ahead. There are many bumps ahead, and we should follow up very deeply what is going on to know if this plan is going to be implemented, and more important, to know what is exactly the agreement that people talk about. So, in short, the hard work has not been done. This is fake news, to use the expression that President Trump likes so much. And we have to watch out and see what the coming negotiations will lead to.
All right, very important words that you've stated there, Ambassador. You mentioned not a deal, not an agreement, many ambiguous points. But with that being said, what can we expect in the next phase of the Gaza deal and the rebuilding process?
Well, the next phase, if I heard your question well, will be negotiations about the implementation of this peace plan. I mean, what I have seen is the 20-point plan that has been published a long time, a couple of weeks ago. But here what I expect and what we should see is that President Trump is going to put a lot of pressure on the mediators for them to exert pressure on Hamas to disarm and so on. But on the other hand, the mediators, and especially Egypt, are going to ask for clarifications and put some pressure, if they can, on the United States and Israel to clarify the many ambiguous clauses or paragraphs of the plan that contain the obligations of Israel. So now we have stopped the war, but there is talk about, in addition to disarmament, the most important point for Egypt is the complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces from Gaza, because the plan gives a triple safety net for Israel to stay in the strip of land that connects Egypt to Gaza, what they call the Philadelphia Corridor. In the first phase that has been implemented, Israel withdraws, has a limited withdrawal. They have now 55% to 60% of Gaza, including, of course, the Philadelphia Corridor. In another paragraph, paragraph 16 specifically, there is talk about a full and complete withdrawal after negotiation to agree on the conditions. But this complete withdrawal will be saved for a security perimeter that includes the Philadelphia Corridor. I am sure that Egypt will not sign to anything that means a modification or an amendment to the annexes to the Camp David Accord, because the annexes to the Camp David Accord, the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, do specify that Israel should not be on the border between Gaza and Egypt. And this is a very important point for the national security of Egypt.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Reader News Analysis. To stay tuned for the Onkona Nadingi program brought to you by Lucy Shimi. From Indafa, happy Shishu, it is goodbye. Have yourself a wonderful Wednesday afternoon ahead.